The Committee of Higher Education and Workforce Development will now be in order. Today's date is Tuesday, February 17th. So again, today we'll be going from 2 to 4, and as we looked at our schedule between now and second policy deadline, we have so many bills that we really believe will most likely have to use the up until 4 time between now and then. So if members could just plan on that, we would appreciate it. And again, you know, we always will try and start as close to 2 as possible, but we do wait for a quorum. So today we have a number of bills before us that deal with consumer protections within higher education. We look forward to hearing about the issues in the marketplace and how each of these proposals tend to deal with them. We will not be taking action on the specific bills in terms of passing them. We will have, we hope, robust discussions, ask questions. We'll allow those who object to the bills to have a chance to say why they object to them, and then we'll lay them on the table. You can expect that this committee will address this overall issue in some way this session. So we'll decide whether it's this approach. We may use one of the bills. We may also go with, as you can recall, we've talked about having the metrics approach, whereby we say that if you fall outside of our desired outcomes, you no longer have access to state grant dollars. So that would be another possibility, or a dual possibility in terms of direction. So I just wanted to make sure everybody was aware of that as you listen to them, to be thinking about the bills in that context. So we'll start with Senator Benson, with Senate File 329. And members, also, if you do see a potential for possible amendments, you're welcome to bring that up as well. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for allowing me to present Senate File 329. I have the privilege of wearing two hats. I am a policymaker and a mom, and this bill hits both of those quite directly. I have asked that a Wall Street Journal article about Purdue be placed into your packets. It just heightens some things that you as committee members know well. We have $1.3 trillion in student debt nationally. College graduates are actually delaying major purchases like purchasing homes and cars because of the amount of debt that they're carrying. 45% of our graduates age 25 and under are living with family. We are looking at a permanent drag on our economy because they are missing opportunities to save and invest and prepare for their future. Minnesota ranks fifth in student debt, and the average debt of Minnesota students is around $31,000 a year. And again, this will have a long-term impact on our economy. As a mom, I have begun the process of looking at colleges for my son. They're really upfront about their benefits, tutoring, the wellness centers, the excellence of their professors. I didn't find them to be as upfront about the risks that you take when entering a college. How long will it take me to graduate? How much will I owe when I graduate? Will I be able to get a job when I graduate? And so as consumers, I am hoping this bill will be part of your overall package to create more transparency, to help parents and students make better upfront decisions about their education so that they leave with better prospects for employment and less debt, and hopefully finishing on time because they've made a good educational plan. As we look directly at the bill, we are focused on the marketing materials that they use for recruiting their students. I hope to meet consumers where they are. Much of this information is available at the Office of Higher Education or at the U.S. Department of Education, but with most other transactions, from every item of food that you buy, clothing, all the labels are where the consumers are. So I'm asking that this information, instead of being stored on a distant website, be brought up front to the consumers. Again, our goal is a more engaged consumer, less debt, and better outcomes, happier students, and more successful students when they graduate from our public programs. Tried to keep my summary brief, but I am happy to stand for questions.
Questions? Senator Torres-Wray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Benson, I am wondering, I had a visit from a group of students who brought an interesting question to me about the report that came out and actually gives us an idea of the cost of the different programs. So it just says, you know, if you go into the social work program at the University of Minnesota, this is the cost of the program. However, the cost of the program is not the cost for the individual. So for the university, the cost of, I think, education was an example, was, I think, $9,000 to $12,000 in a given time. But the cost to the student is about $35,000. So the question was, why is that we don't ask, why is that the cost to the student is almost three or four times higher than the cost for the university? So where does the money go? And I'm interested to hear if you have heard about that and whether or not, because when we talk about the cost to the student, one could say that we could tell you, you know, what you pay for in terms of the individual cost, but the institution's cost is greater. And I don't know if you have thought about that and whether or not you think that fits into what we need to ask in terms of transparency, because then we will understand what the actual cost is, not just, you know, of the program, but where the money actually goes, because I think that's kind of an enigma to a lot of people, too.
Senator Benson.
And thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Torres-Ray. That's outside the purview of what I've prepared for this committee. But frankly, I think the more innovative we get in our approach to higher education, the more transparent those costs will be, and students will find an education program that much more closely matches the cost with the value that they're going to find from it. So while it's outside the scope of what I think this bill can accomplish, I think it is something that, as part of reform going forward, I think we're going to see great innovations in online schools, in changing the way campuses engage students. We're going to have much more hybrid approach to our higher education system, and I think it's questions like that that are going to lead us to those changes.
Thank you. Senator Kent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Benson, thank you for bringing this forward. I share very much your concern about the importance of disclosure of information, and the more we can inform our students and their families, the better off everybody will be. So I very much support the intent of what you're doing here. I do have some concerns, you know, as we've worked, for example, with the SLEDS data and some of the correlations, the required disclosures and the specificity of those, the devil is always in the details. And, you know, whether you get into people wanting to maintain privacy about some of their education-related data, there are just so many moving parts to all of this. Have you considered if there are ways to maybe do, for example, like three of the four or something like that to allow some flexibility so that we can achieve the purpose of the disclosure, but perhaps allow for some of the challenges inherent in trying to gather and report the data?
And I'm sorry.
Yes, Senator Benson.
Madam Chair and Senator Kent, thank you. Much of what I'm asking, and I believe I have it constructed fairly closely to what is already required in Minnesota Statute 36A 1.21 for those institutions that have Pell Grant recipients, they already have to have enrollment persistence, graduation data, job placement rate, salary and wage information by program, student debt to earnings ratio, and they already have to report those. So this legislation doesn't expand the granularity of the data, and I think that's primarily your concern.
Okay. Thank you.
And Senator Benson, council's nodding, so
thank you.
Good job, good work. No, you're not. Senator Benson, you know, I have asked you, and I presume others have as well, about why you didn't choose to include the not-for-profit privates as well as the for-profits. So can you address that?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I forgot to address that in my summary, so I appreciate the opportunity. I did only include those institutions that we have given our imprimatur to. Only select institutions can say they are a Minnesota institution. And while others might have students that receive state grant money, I think we have a higher responsibility to those that we call Minnesota institutions. And I respect that the committee might differ with me on that, but I am not inclined to stick my nose in to private institutions unless it is the will of the committee.
Well, Senator Benson, I don't know how the other committee members feel. If we were to move forward with this legislation, I would prefer it to be across all sectors, because I think that when students make a choice, part of what they do is they look competitively. And so we always hear, particularly from our not-for-profit privates, that they actually beat our public institutions on many measures. They'll show us that their graduation rate or their job placement or their default rate. And so they speak with great pride about these things, and they all actually report to the Office of Higher Ed, because to have access to our state grant dollars, they do have to report. So it would be my opinion that, you know, we wouldn't pick a sector, but I hear the author's intent, and I would be interested in what other members thought. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I understand both sides of this. I am very reluctant also for government to step into what private entities and businesses, or in this case, higher education, is doing. I'm certainly not a fan of government being involved in any type of price setting or anything like that. But I would say that I differ a little bit from my colleague, Senator Benson, in that when we have students who are using our state grant, that's a different category, because those are taxpayer dollars, and we are accountable for how those taxpayer dollars are used. So I would choose an approach that is a little bit more in the middle, which would be to include any institutions that receive state taxpayer dollars, whether it be through direct grants to the institutions like Minsky and the U of M, or via the students through the student grant, through the state aid, state grant.
Senator Nelson, that was my thinking as well.
Okay.
Yeah. So, anybody else? Senator Benson.
Madam Chair, if I may, much of my legislative knowledge comes from the healthcare side. And when, for example, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services establishes a standard, because of pressure and standards, many of the private healthcare plans adopt that standard as well. And so I think if we set our Minnesota institutions up reporting this way to remain competitive, the private institutions would follow. And so I think the market can handle some of the reporting, but I understand the will of the committee might differ from my view.
Thank you. Anybody else, just so we get a broader sense of where the committee stands on this issue?
Well, just
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one clarification, though, that I don't think that we should have this in place for private institutions that are not, that do not receive state grant dollars.
So,
in one way, one
Senator
form
Nelson,
or another.
There, right, for sure. There aren't very many. So I think right now Capella does not. I'm trying to think other institutions that accredited institutions that don't get
any other.
That's it. So Capella wouldn't have to comply.
Okay.
Okay.
Maybe
easier to. Anybody else want to comment? Yes, Senator Sharon.
I was just trying to get a read for what
Thank you.
That I think when we are using, especially when we're talking about increasing the caps on these grants to accommodate to all sorts of institutions, that we have an obligation to make certain that the students who go there have accurate information. So I'm supportive of articulating it from that perspective, that our interest in it is because we're using public resources and we have a right then to have an expectation from that. There are very few institutions that won't affect. That doesn't really bother me. But I think that as students start to do comparisons and they see this information existing in other institutions but not available in some other, they would probably start to ask for it.
Thank you very much. So, Senator Benson, I think you get a sense for where the committee's at. And again, we're just going to lay it over today anyway, but want to make sure that you do have a sense of that. And if there are those in the audience who would like to testify, so do you have anyone to testify in support with you today?
Madam Chair, I am just here as a consumer and a senator. So
very good. But so if there are folks who would like to testify in opposition, you'll have that chance after I do the next bill. And then we'll take opposition on both the bills at the same time because they'll be kind of similar opposition. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And will someone move the bill?
Sure. Move to layover for possible inclusion.
I will.
Senator Pratt moves that Senate file 329 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Senator Miller.
Madam Chair, I just have a question. If since we're laying this over, and when would we make? It sounds like the committee wants to make some changes or amendments. When would we do that?
Senator Miller, we would do that when we were putting together our policy bill.
Okay.
Yep, and we would, I think council has listened that, Mr. Fuller, that we would like to make that change when that time comes, so we would like an amendment to reflect that. Very good.
Okay, thank you, Madam
Chair. So all those in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now I'll turn the gavel over to Senator Clausen.
Senator Boniff, welcome to the committee. And you have two bills. Which would you like to take up first, please?
Senate File 696, please.
And do you have any amendments?
No, I do not.
Please move ahead. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, members, this also is a disclosure bill. And this bill I'm actually offering on behalf of the Attorney General. So you may have read this summer that the Attorney General announced that they had concerns with what they perceived to be a lack of disclosure to students attending for-profit private colleges. They were concerned around practices that seemed misleading of students who were entering the schools. And so the Attorney General, I remember reading at the time, announced that it was her intention to craft some potential legislation to put forward to address the problems that they found. On a parallel path, as you all know, we have been going down a different approach, looking at this idea of using the metrics as our approach. But I did contact the Attorney General and said that I want, out of respect for the Attorney General, that I wanted to make sure that their legislative proposals were heard by the committee and the committee would have a chance to act. And so rather than me take you through these bills, I'm honored to have our Assistant Attorney General here to take you through this first bill, which is 696.
Thank you, Senator Boniff, and good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kirsi Pupor. I'm an Assistant Attorney General in the Minnesota Attorney General's Office. Before you is Senate File 696. This is a bill that would require for-profit colleges to provide clear, accurate, and transparent information to students as part of the enrollment process so that students are able to make sound and informed decisions before committing a lot of time and a lot of money to pursuing higher education. Now, over the past year alone, our office has received hundreds of complaints from students of for-profit colleges regarding misrepresentations that have been made to them during the enrollment process. These complaints have made it very clear to our office that stronger standards are needed to protect students. The complaints are in several main areas. First of all, we've heard from a lot of students that for-profit schools are recommending and enrolling them in programs that will not allow them to accomplish their career goals. For instance, several schools have recommended and enrolled students in criminal justice programs after the students tell the schools, I would like to be a police officer. Mr. Zerwas, who's right here, he will testify in a few minutes regarding his experience. Another thing that we've heard from a lot of students is that students are assured by for-profit schools that their credits will transfer. They're told, don't worry if this isn't the school for you, or if you want to continue your education after getting your associate's degree here, not a problem. Other schools accept our credits. We're accredited. End of story. Now, when students graduate or decide that the school is not right for them, they discover that in many cases, other institutions, nonprofit institutions, state schools, community colleges will not accept the majority, most if not all of the credits from their prior school. Another issue we've identified, both our office and in bipartisan law enforcement investigations all over the country, is that for-profit schools are playing with job placement rates. Many schools use high job placement rates to solicit and enroll students in their programs. They'll be told something like 90% of our business administration graduates find a job in their field of study or are placed in a job in their field of study at graduation. When we've reviewed the job placement information for graduates, however, we've discovered that jobs such as a Starbucks barista or a Quick Trip cashier, those are the kinds of jobs that are often being reported as placed graduates, jobs that don't require any type of college degree, jobs that students had before they enrolled, before they decided to pursue education and get more career opportunities. Some jobs that are being counted as placements are temporary jobs lasting several days or a week. Other jobs are jobs that are completely unrelated to the student's field of study. For instance, in one of our investigations, criminal justice graduates were being reported as placed for jobs like secretary or nursing assistant. Just to give you an example, one of the individuals that is part of one of our cases, he's a 32-year-old Navy veteran. He enrolled in the Minnesota School of Business's Bachelor Degree Business Management program. After he was told we're a military-friendly school, we have a prestigious reputation, and 90% of our business graduates find work or are placed in a job at graduation. About halfway through his program, he discovered that Rochester Community and Technical College was about half the cost of MSB. He considered transferring and found out that his credits would not transfer. He did complete his program at MSB, and because his GI Bill benefits did not cover the cost of his program, he took out $20,000 in student loans. After graduation, he informed the school that he was working as a bartender. He worked for 2 days in a customer service position that paid him $12 an hour, and he was counted as a placed graduate for that job. And that gentleman continues to work in the restaurant industry as a server and bartender. I have several individuals here to testify today. To my left is Dylan Zerwas. Dylan is 20 years old. He lives in Prior Lake. Dylan has known since he was a young boy that he wanted to be a police officer. And he's enrolled in Normandale Community College's law enforcement program, but prior to that, he was enrolled in the Minnesota School of Business's criminal justice program. This is a program that was recommended to him after he met on three different occasions with his parents in the Minnesota School of Business, told them, my dream is to become a police officer, and the school recommended and enrolled him in their program. Dylan will be testifying about his experience at the Minnesota School of Business.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Zerwas, and if you could state your name.
My name is Dylan Zerwas.
Very good. Thank you.
So I enrolled in the Minnesota School of Business with the intent of obtaining a law enforcement degree to become a police officer. After meeting with registration financial aid, I signed up for the criminal justice major, having been advised that this was the accredited major and what I needed in order to get a college degree. After attending school for less than 2 weeks, I discovered that the criminal justice degree offered at the school is accredited nationally, not regionally, meaning it's only valid when entering the fields of corrections, parole officer, and security positions. I felt as if they're trying to take advantage of me because I've never done anything with colleges, schools, or anything like that, and you know, I was inexperienced. I'm trying to enter the law enforcement field because I believe it's my purpose to protect people and save them. And I felt as if that this school and these people weren't helping me with that, that they just wanted the money. So.
Thank you, Dylan.
Thank you for your testimony. Thank you.
I also have to my right here Jill Myers. Jill is 31. She lives in Coon Rapids with her husband and her three-year-old daughter. Jill earned a bachelor's degree in healthcare management from the Minnesota School of Business, and she has $80,000 in student loans from that degree. Minnesota School of Business's job placement records indicate that Jill was a PLACE graduate. She was counted towards the job placement rates that are advertised and used to solicit and enroll students in that program. Jill is here to testify a little bit about her graduate employment and her attempts to continue her education after graduating from the Minnesota School of Business.
Thank you. Ms. Myers, welcome to the committee. And if you again, for the record, could state your name.
Thank you. My name is Jill Myers. Yes, I attended Minnesota School of Business in 2007 and attempt to have a healthcare management degree. Intent of making $50,000 per year. Well, it came down to graduating when I remember vaguely that I was in a line to actually get my diploma, and everybody was whispering. I was like, what's going on? Yeah, didn't you hear? We just got an email saying our credits don't transfer. I'm like, what are you talking about? Are you serious? Went home that night and checked my email, and it said that your credits do not transfer. So if you, and that's it, basically that. And then when I tried to go out in the field to get a job, Chrissy was nice enough to bring a document to my attention. Minnesota School of Business forged my signature regarding that I was placed in a career position according to my degree. I was actually just a file clerk at a Seracare. I was not a manager at a nursing home like I wanted, like I dreamed. Instead, they put for, this really gets me, instead of putting that I actually just file, they like to elaborate and said I was a medical billing contact and I investigated and maintained private insurance, which I did not. I literally got paid $13 an hour to file for 8 hours. So it was pretty disappointing. So I'm not getting any jobs. No job leads whatsoever. I went to try to get my credits transferred, made an appointment for St. Kate's to see maybe I can go to nursing, finish up, maybe start my nursing degree or something, or get my master's in healthcare management, something, because this is not working out. Went to go, no credits transferred. And I'm like, $80,000 in debt and none of my credits transfer? I would have to start fresh. So, yeah, it was pretty disappointing. And I remember when I, it was just disappointing. I'm just speechless, sorry.
I'm speechless.
Yes.
These stories are just heartbreaking. Both of you, I very much appreciate you coming forward and sharing your stories. And it relates why we're here today and listening to the bill that's being proposed. So, again, thank you so much.
Thanks,
Mr. Chair.
And I believe we have another person who will testify.
We have two other students that could, Mr. Chair, if the committee would like to hear their testimony.
Chair. Is that on this bill, 696?
Yes. Mr. Chair, I have a question for a student. Would you rather wait till later or for the two students that are here?
So we're going to be hearing a few more students. Why don't we move ahead, Senator Nelson, with your question.
Oh, yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a question for Ms. Myers. I think we're all a bit aghast and appreciate the fact that you're willing to come and tell us about this today. Forgery is a crime, And I would like to know, one, who, I heard you say Christy, or I'm not sure, somebody. Who got you the paper that had a forged signature?
Christy did.
Christy from the Attorney General's office?
Yes.
Okay. And then it would be helpful if we got a copy of that paper. Forgery is a serious crime, and it's something that I think we need to actually see. And then my next question would be to Christy. How did you get that document?
Mr. Chair and Senator, we have an open case pending right now in Hennepin County against Globe University and Minnesota School of Business, so that document was produced as part of that law enforcement investigation and now litigation.
Thank you.
Any other questions for the two student testifiers at this time? Why don't we move ahead then with your additional testifiers?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair?
Excuse me. Yes, Senator Nelson.
Just one more comment. I think it's interesting, though, that we're hearing about, maybe everyone else knew there was a lawsuit. I did not until right now. So I think it's interesting that, while one, we weren't told that, and usually when there's lawsuits pending, there's kind of quiet until actually those lawsuits are handled. So I just needed to state that for the record. I'm disappointed that we did not know that there was a lawsuit involving this. And I'm also hoping that at the end of the day, or before we leave this public comment, as distressing as these comments are, and I don't want to take anything away from them at all, because it is a very, they are very distressing stories, I would hope that we would also hear from the plaintiff or the defendant in this case as well. Today. I don't know if there's someone here, but I think that's an important balance that we would actually hear. So thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Senator Chair, Bonner. Senator Nelson, you know, we weren't really apprised of the status of a lawsuit, and so that I was not looking at this as being a part of that proceeding. Mm-hmm. So that is interesting, but I was looking at the legislation on its face value, but when, of course, you have something set on the public record, when there is a lawsuit proceeding, I can understand why you would ask that question. I don't think we want our legislative hearing to be a basis for any court decisions.
Exactly. Thank you.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, just to be clear, the issues we've identified, the problems we've identified, and our reasons for proposing this legislation go far beyond the case. Ms. Myers, Mr. Zerwas did attend school there, but we've received, as I said earlier, hundreds of complaints from students from numerous colleges. It's not limited to one school, and there's many other law enforcement investigations and cases brought by both Democratic and Republican attorney generals all over the country mm-hmm. regarding these issues.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Nelson.
I don't want to leave this because I think it's intriguing. So these are significant issues, and I'm glad that we are addressing them in this committee. This is where they should be addressed. But if there are other schools as well, I would hope that our witnesses also then are from a broader sector. I'm just worried that we're using this hearing as part of a court hearing doc. And so I'm just really concerned that this is taking place today with the very same witnesses and the very same case that you're trying before court today. I just don't recall us doing that in the Minnesota Senate before.
Your comments are well taken, Senator. Thank you. Ms. Papor, would you like to introduce your next?
Mr. Chair and committee members, I don't have any other witnesses. I would like to go through the bill very quickly. There's three things that we're asking for as part of this bill. First, we're asking for accurate and transparent disclosures related to job placement information and the transferability of schools' credits. Second, we're asking that schools disclose whether or not their programs, as applicable, are programmatically accredited. As an example of another institution, in 2013, we did settle a case against Herzing University, which was recommending and enrolling students in their medical assistant program, which was not programmatically accredited, which meant that students could not sit for the certified medical assistant examination, and it really decreased their chances of finding a job, as many employers will only employ CMAs. So as an example of another institution, that was a big issue for students. They couldn't get jobs as medical assistants because they couldn't sit for that exam. Finally, we're asking that schools act in a student's best interest in recommending and enrolling them in a particular program that promises to train students for a particular degree or for a particular field of study or career. Thank you.
Thank you. We do have one additional testifier that's on our list, Dr. Turner Berg.
And Mr. Chair, that he's welcome to come forward in just a moment, but that would be in opposition, and so we'll do that in just a minute.
Very good.
And Mr. Chair, if I might.
Yes.
So one of the concerns with regard to this bill that has been brought before us came from the Office of Higher Education with regard to our participation in SARA. So you might remember in our last year we passed the legislative intent to join the SARA Compact so that students in Minnesota can get credit for online classes that they take elsewhere. And this is a national movement. Each region is working on getting all their states to participate. So there was some concern that because of certain things in this bill that it actually would interfere with our ability to participate. And Sarah, this has not yet been worked out. Judiciary has asked to see this bill, but we're today recommending this bill be laid on the table until those issues can be worked out.
Very good. Would you like to take that action now?
I believe that the Assistant Attorney General does not agree with my decision, and so I'd like to let her have a chance to say what she has to say about that.
And Ms. Porpor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Our office has taken a look at the SARA Compact, and we do believe that we can remain a SARA state with these additional requirements. SARA, the way that the legislation was passed last year, it exempts SARA schools from MnSTATs 136A, which is related to reporting requirements. SARA's governs the academic standards for admittance into the state. We are proposing this as a separate consumer protection statute that is not under OHEs as far as report. It's not a reporting requirement. It's disclosures that are provided to students so that they can make informed decisions about their educational future.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Senator Torres Ray, then Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a question to the Assistant Attorney General. First, I'm very appreciative of this review. I know that this has been a response to, like you said, hundreds of complaints, and obviously we have constituents who are suffering, like the individuals who came here. So I'm very appreciative of this review, and I know that we can rely on your expertise and review to move legislation forward, so I appreciate it. I am curious to hear from you as to whether or not you had an opportunity to review the profile of the individuals who are attending these colleges. I had a conversation with some faculty that argues that a lot of the individuals who are coming to the colleges, the young students, are actually coming to these colleges as a last resource, that they have not been able to get into other places, and therefore they look for this opportunity. And then they are giving this information in a way that kind of opens a door that was close to them so many times because of whatever circumstances. And so I don't know if you're able to offer that to us, because in my opinion that creates an additional kind of vulnerability to these individuals if the students have not been able to enter other institutions, been able to pursue other programs, and this is kind of the last step. And they're willing to pay whatever it takes because they want their kids to enter these institutions. I don't know if you can offer some light into that. I don't know if you were able to get some of that information or not.
Ms. Pupor.
Mr. Chair and Senator Torres-Ray, as far as the there's been many public reports about many non-traditional students attending for-profit schools. That is, we don't share, you know, individual complaint information unless individuals are willing to testify. However, that is, there's many non-traditional students. Very few of the students that are attending these institutions are first-time, full-time students. It's students that have a lot of other things going on in their lives. However, you know, we think that any type of student that is enrolling, whether it's Dylan, who was, you know, in high school, his parents were involved, this was his first attempt at college, or someone else who maybe they've tried another school, they should all be entitled to the same information and disclosures, whether or not they're a first-time student or, you know, a student that's tried three or four times.
Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do think that it's very important that we understand this profile. I understand from your perspective that you need to attend to perhaps the calls of everybody regardless. But for us as policymakers, when we know of a profile of a student who is seeking an opportunity, and then there is a tendency for an institution to kind of take advantage of an individual because they fit that profile, as lawmakers, we need to be attentive to that. So I would be very interested, Mr. Chairman, in requesting some of the information about the profile of the students who pursue these colleges, because I do think that if there is true that there is a tendency to take advantage, I would, as a parent, think that, you know, if I'm offered an opportunity and then my kid was not able to attend some of the colleges and I'm been giving this information and promises as to what my kid is going to do, I probably will be in a vulnerable place to make a decision. And I think that is very relevant to this review and to the decision that we need to make in order to fix this problem.
Senator Torres-Ray, would this be a request for the Attorney General's office?
I think it's more to higher ed, Mr. Chair. I think that I hear from you that you didn't do this review, but I think higher ed, the institutions, I think, Mr. Chair, through us, we need to request kind of some information as to who are the students, you know, what kind of money are they paying, what kind of alternatives are they being offered. So that's kind of more our responsibility and higher ed, in my opinion.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair,
Ms.
if I may. Mr. Chair and Senator Torres-Ray, just to give you a little bit more information, I mean, many of the complaints our office does receive are from non-traditional students, students who, you know, perhaps a young single mom with two children who thinks the only way for me to better my life is to go back to school and get a degree so I can get a better paying job, or another complaint, a woman that we received a complaint from, she worked in a factory type assembly job for many years. She's laid off. She lives in a small town. The factory closes, and she thinks my only chance at getting a job is to go back to school. So I'm not sure if this completely answers your question, but we do receive many complaints from non-traditional students who are really desperately trying to better their lives with an education, and what draws them in, what we've heard is that I was drawn into the school because I thought it was a great place to start. I thought I can always go somewhere else. They promised me these high job placement rates. They promised me job placement assistance. Those are many of the complaints we're receiving.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Boniff.
Mr. Chair, Senator Torres-Ray, I know we can get that information for you, so we'll do that. And also, I would just add that as we talked about on Senator Benson's bill, the possibility of including all the sectors, it might be appropriate with regard to this bill as well, because do we really want to be in the practice of singling out one industry if the problem is disclosure? And we think disclosure is of the highest value for our students, then whatever vehicles we use and put forward, I recommend personally, and again, the will of the committee, but that we consider all sectors.
Senator, your point is well taken, and we'll proceed with gathering that information. We have Senator Nelson, and then followed by Senator Kent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Bonoff, I greatly appreciate your last comments there. I do think that, if I'm not mistaken, I think the White House had a similar proposal to this that was just to for-profits. And it seems to me that if we are really interested in full disclosure and in helping students, we definitely would need to have a uniform policy. So this would apply to our publics as well. And I certainly appreciate your effort in that regard. And so there are some real issues here that need to be addressed. In fact, I did an interview today about the high cost of student debt and why is it that Minnesota is leading. We should not be leading on that list. That's a list you don't want to be at the top of. And yet we're number four, or maybe this year number five. And maybe these are some reasons. And maybe this legislation can help us in that. So I appreciate the intent of the legislation, but I do find it very distressing that a bill about disclosure did not get disclosure from the Attorney General's office that this very thing was in the midst of a lawsuit. I find that a bit ironic. But now for my question. I noticed in one of the testimonies, I think it was Dylan, the issue on these credits that don't transfer. I know how difficult that is. That happened to our older son. So I understand the cost of that. And also, sometimes kids just don't finish them. So there's a double cost. But my question is, I understood that the problem was the credits transferred nationally but not regionally. And so the question would be, is there something wrong here regionally? If these credits transfer nationally, what is so unusual about our region that they wouldn't transfer regionally? And I'm not sure who can answer that question. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, and Senator we may Bonner. Need somebody from OHE to come to the table or perhaps council. But as I understand it, it's a degree of accreditation, and the higher degree of accreditation is a regional accreditation, and so the top colleges and universities in Minnesota are accredited regionally, and that is the gold standard. The national accreditation is a different type of accreditation, and so if for-profits that are accredited nationally and not regionally, they wouldn't measure up to the higher standard, and that's why their credits don't transfer. So, for example, College of St. Thomas, that's a regionally accredited university. So it's contrary to how you common sense would think, and there people are nodding that yes. I did accurately state that.
So Mr. Chair,
yes, Senator Nelson.
Chairman Bonoff, so it is very counterintuitive.
Exactly.
So even if a parent or a student asked, they would be told we're accredited nationally. One would think that would even be higher than regional accreditation.
Exactly.
So as we go through this, we might need to have some actual further definition of terms. But thank you for that clarification.
Mr. Chair, may I offer one additional comment on that issue?
Ms. Purpore, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Nelson as well. Your question here just points out the issue that we're trying to address. Students are not advised that their credits won't transfer, and in many cases they're told by for-profit schools, the majority of which are nationally accredited, your credits will transfer. We're nationally accredited. But what that doesn't disclose is that all of the MNSCU, our state schools, and the majority of nonprofit schools in Minnesota are not nationally accredited. They're regionally accredited, and for the most part, they don't accept most, if not all, of nationally accredited schools' credits. Thank you.
That's bad. Thank you. Senator Kent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had the opportunity to visit an institution near my district recently and was really pleased, disturbed by one story, but pleased by their approach. And I wanted to ask Ms. Purpore if this would fall under the heading of what you're trying to address with this bill. In this case, the institution said that if they have students approach them, prospective students approach them, saying they want to pursue a program in law enforcement, that they would find out, for one thing, if they had, for example, a criminal background that might preclude them from some law enforcement careers, and if they did find that out, they would advise that student on what their real options were and help them make a good decision that fit their actual life situation. So when you say that this bill would act in the student's best interest in terms of recommending particular programs, would this address that kind of situation if a school was not prepared to do that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Kent, our bill does not impose an affirmative obligation for a school to question a student about their criminal background. We have heard from students who have told schools, I have two DUIs. Will I be able to be a police officer? And they're told, don't worry. You just get it expunged. Don't worry about it. That's, as we all know, that's not accurate. And that does go to some extent, the duty to act in a student's best interest, determine suitability. If that's information that's provided to a school as part of that meeting with the school where a program is recommended based on the student's interests and skills, and that is disclosed, that would be part of our bill where a school should act in their best interest and tell them, you know what, you're going to have a hard time becoming a police officer if you have two DUIs on your record.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just a comment, Counselor Fuller has reminded me in Section 2, Subdivision 2, duty to act in the student's best interest really opens up the institution for lawsuits in the event they do not act in the student's best interest. So I think that was your comment, Mr. Fuller.
Exactly right. Mr. Chairman, yes, if you look at page 5, line 32 through 34 of the violations, that section 8.31 is a catch-all of remedies, including a private right of action, a lot of remedies. So when you connect that with the duty in section 2 to act in a student's best interest, which is, you know, a debatable question, you tie those two together and you can see that there may be some litigation along with subdivision 3. But that section 5 is, I assume that's why it's going to judiciary, because it has equitable relief, a lot of remedies, a lot of penalties, punitive damages.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator. We believe that a school should always act in a student's best interest, and that is part of the scheme of this legislation, which is disclosures, transparency, and also determining suitability. If you have a specific question, I'm sorry, if you have a specific question you'd like me to address.
Mr. I think it was simply a comment pointing out it.
Thank you.
Senator Bonoff, would you like to move Senate File 696?
Be laid on the table for possible inclusion. Sure.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Oh, Senator Pratt had a question there.
I'm sorry. I thought there was another testifier that was going to testify before we moved it.
So we're going to have the opponents, because we're not moving the bill anyway, speak after, because there some people want to speak about the first bill too, Senator Benson's.
Okay.
But if you would like to hear it first, it's fine.
I'm just confused on the procedure.
Thank you.
Sorry,
Senator Kloss.
Senator Sharon.
I don't think we need to make a motion. You can lay a table.
Just lay it on the table.
And have it be included in the omnibus policy or finance bill from higher ed. So we really don't need
a motion.
Because we will vote on it in the end.
Exactly.
And it allows everybody time to work on language and amendments.
Thank you.
Very good. Senate File 696 will be laid over for consideration. And Senator Bonoff, you have a second bill.
No, I'd like that testifier to come up now.
Testifier, very good.
In opposition.
Welcome to the committee, and if you could state your name, please, for the record.
Absolutely. My name is Dr. Turner Bird, and I am the president of Le Cordon Bleu College for Culinary Arts. I'm actually here today to speak on behalf of MCCA, the Minnesota Career College Association. A bit of information about our association is we represent roughly 60% of the students enrolled at career colleges in the state of Minnesota. Our institutions are located across the state, and our programs range from the culinary arts to business to technology and healthcare. Our institutions have students enrolled in programs everywhere from the certificate level to the graduate level. Our average age of our students are 27, and 75% of those students are female. Over 70% of the student population at our schools has prior college education. and a majority of the students remain in the state of Minnesota after graduation. Rather than trying to go through every section of the bill that's been proposed, we've put together a summary that's included in a letter that we've provided to the committee. It's organized by referencing the page and line in the bill of the particular topic. We believe that in some cases we're simply asking a question about the language. In other cases, we believe the language is vague. And in other cases, the language seems to be in conflict with federal and state regulations and or existing accrediting body regulations. I'd like to expound a bit before I move forward on a couple sections of the bill. And since we were just talking about the duty to act in the student's best interest, which is Section 2, Subdivision 2, I would restate that a private, for-profit, post-secondary school shall at all times act in a student's best interest and in the utmost good faith toward the student, which, of course, is something that we implicitly support. However, I would give an example where this language is somewhat vague and could lead to issues when it comes to how we would lead our institutions to comply with this subdivision. I would give the example of transfer credit, as we've spoken about. There are times in the higher education sector where decisions on transfer credit are made, and typically solely made, from an educational standpoint. So we would look at the contact hours of the prior institution. We would look at a course syllabus to seek understanding if the concepts that the receiving institution are looking to deliver have been met, hence that would qualify as a transfer credit. However, conversely, that student would not receive that transfer credit, hence their overall cost of their program would include that extra course. So I would point out that depending on how you would view that subdivision, and depending on your angle on if you're looking at it from an educational delivery standpoint or an overall cost standpoint, there could be conflicting views depending on what perspective you're looking at. And, of course, this subdivision doesn't expound on that, where some confusion could potentially lie. I would also go to Subdivision 3 in this exact area that states a duty to determine suitability. And I would reference the sentence, the suitability of a recommended program will be determined by reference to the totality of the particular student's circumstances, including but not limited to. So we're talking about an admissions representative or institution in an enrollment sequence that can vary from something that would happen over a day's time to something that could extend out for months and months as the institution works with the student answering questions, they're going through their decision-making process. This subdivision is asking the institution to understand the totality of the student's essentially entire existence. So in order to fully comply with that, we would need to take that very seriously and gather a lot of information about what are the key indicators that are risk factors when a student's entering an institution. I can tell you that when you look at the research, and there's a lot of research in this area, one of the highest risk factor, if you will, aggregates, are single mothers. So the idea that we would gather that, or let's say race or geography, and front load that determination and those factors to potentially create an algorithm of some sort that would allow folks to enter and other folks not to enter could potentially be part of this legislation. When we look at future likelihood for a specific individual in these risk indicators to expound a bit on where we could come into some issues with federal law when you know the ins and outs of the admissions process in proprietary education. You realize that there are a number of things we cannot ask students. We would be in violation of federal law. One example would be we cannot probe and ask students about diagnosed or otherwise learning disabilities. And that federal law is in place to protect students in those situations from being discriminated against so that they cannot be allowed into the institution. Of course, if we were to take the language being proposed here, which as a leader of an institution I would need to seriously consider, of course, full compliance, we would need to gather data such as that in order to make an attempt at guarding the institution from legal action, and we would need to cross boundaries that are already set. So it's an example of where, you know, that relates to the language that's included here and how it doesn't mesh with many of the regulations, many of the best practices and mandates that are in place from a federal as well as a accrediting body standpoint. Similar to this in other sections of the proposed bill, there are questions that we raise, including if we look above at subdivision 14 as we define what a student would be. One of the things that's noted there is a student means any individual physically located in the state of Minnesota who inquires about, applies for, or. So we would be defining a student as anyone who inquires to an institution. And we would need further clarification on, for instance, if someone's grandmother or parent inquired into the institution for them, which of course happens a lot, would we then be defining those folks as a student? So I wanted to add a little bit of clarity, if you will, or information on MCCA's view of the legislation. We are in a place where we are not opposed or the latter. However, proposing that we hopefully can take a closer look at what's being presented here. The note was made that the devil is in the details, and there are definitely a lot of details included here that redefine, or there's duplicity. For instance, if the state were to require us to present placement statistics in a certain way, that's different than how the federal government mandates we present placement statistics, we could end up in a situation where a student would need to be presented with the same set of data in two different ways at the same time during enrollment, which could potentially lead to additional confusion rather than a cohesive, logical set of data where the students can make an informed decision. So I would conclude my general statements, again, that we are not at all opposed to transparency and protections for students. However, I do want to echo Senator Bonoff's comment that we also believe that if we are going to adopt as a state truth in enrollment legislation, that we would do that for all students in the state of Minnesota and not necessarily one bit or section of higher education. So we definitely look forward to working with the committee and all key stakeholders, for instance, that would be interested in demographic data that is collected through the Office of Higher Education and that our group could provide to the committee, and answering any questions that could help clarify some of the issues in that we believe are present in the language of the proposed bill.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Berg, for your testimony. Before we open it up to the committee, Senator Bonoff, Ms. Popor, any comments you'd like to make?
Mr. Chair and committee members, just a few additional comments. First, the concept of suitability is a concept that's in law, in Minnesota law, related to the sale of products like financial products, insurance, annuity. For these for-profit schools, they are selling a product to student based on things like job placement rates and should be responsible for acting in a student's best interest and determining, based on the information that is provided to them, whether or not a program is suitable for that student. Second issue with regard to duplicity, the federal gainful employment regulations consider that state agencies or states may require additional placement information by indicating in those regulations that if that information is provided pursuant to state law, that information along with the accreditor's information must be provided to students. So I don't think there's any issue with conflict there when it's actually discussed in federal regulations. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Senator Nelson.
Just one final comment. I keep thinking these are my final comments. But actually, this legislation that is before us here in 696 does not set a suitability standard. It sets a fiduciary standard, which is a much different level. And I think that that needs to be accounted for here. This is not a suitability standard in this particular legislation. It would be a fiduciary standard.
Very good. Other comments, questions? Great.
Thanks very
thank
much.
Thank you.
And thank you. And Mr. Chair, I understand there are perhaps comments that the MNSCU and the university might like to make around this general discussion. So if they would like to come forward, they should do that.
Yes, opening it up for additional comments from the audience.
Mr. Chairman, my comments are directed solely...
Mr. Iverson, if you could...
Sure, Mr. Chairman, sorry. Todd Iverson, University of Minnesota. My comments are directed solely at Senator Benson's bill, and we just wanted to put on the record that we have been working with her on some language to make sure that the best information is available for students, and we appreciate her bringing this forward. We are concerned with the level of granularity in her bill about exactly how we would get the data that she's looking for, but we're working with her. We think that we made some good progress yesterday, and we will continue to work with her as the committee works on its policy bill. But we just did want to put on the table that there were some concerns about the granularity of the data down to the program level, and we think that we can serve students well at the university level, but when it gets down to the exact program, it gets very difficult and in some cases could be misleading. So, and she recognized that, and we appreciate that, and we're working with her. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Very good. Your comments are noted, Mr. Iverson. Any other comments, testimony from yes, sir. And if you could identify yourself for the record.
Yes, Chair Clausen. My name is Craig Schenecker with the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. And also commenting on Senate File 329, we also met with Senator Benson yesterday to discuss the bill, expressed some concerns similar to those of the university about the level of detail for some of the measures, but also want to be on the record that the system supports disclosures. We already do many disclosures and would like to get to a place where we've got consistency across those disclosures, not having multiple requirements from the federal government or the state that require disclosure that's conflicting or confusing.
Thank you. Your comments are noted. Any additional comments? All right. And Senator, shall we move on to Senate File 697?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that would be great. And so the next two bills, both myself and then Senator Franzen will be around disclosures with regard to loan requirements.
Very good.
So we'll do it in the same fashion.
All right.
So again, members, Senate File 697 is an AG's bill that I'm offering on behalf of the Attorney General. So because of that. And so in that sense, I'm not, you know, offering amendments. I figured that as the committee takes a look at all of these, we can pick and choose how we want to go forward in these, but I wanted to make sure that the proposal was brought before you in the integrity of how the AG's office wanted it. So,
Ms. Papora.
Thank you, Senator Bonoff and Mr. Chair, committee members. The Senate file 697, this is a borrower, student loan borrower bill of rights that we are proposing, asking for transparency and for private student loan servicers to give borrowers basic, straightforward information on both the terms of their loan and their repayment options. Our office has received many complaints that they come out of college to learn that they have accrued tens of thousands of dollars in private student loans. When these students call their servicers to try to find, even get basic information like a copy of their student loan promissory note or loan consolidation information, loan alternative repayment information, they've told us they get the runaround from their servicers. It's frustrating, it's burdensome, and both for parents and for students. A lot of parents, grandparents co-sign these loans. They can't get straight answers. Our office, similarly, as we've written on behalf of consumers to these servicers to try to get information, we often experience the same runaround. For example, just to give you an idea, our office held several meetings with private student loan borrowers to discuss the problems they were experiencing with their servicers to figure out how best to address them. Now, in one of these meetings, we met with a gentleman who is behind on his student loan payments. He's unemployed currently, and he's getting multiple calls from debt collectors every day. During our meeting, the debt collector actually called his phone. He puts the collector on speakerphone in our presence and asked for some basic loan information, some information about repayment options, and was told by the debt collector, look, that's not our job. We're trying to collect payment. You owe us several hundred dollars. That's why we're calling you. That's not the way that student loan borrower should be treated. Another citizen who wrote to our office, she's a 76-year-old widow. She lives on Social Security, and she tried to help her granddaughter out by co-signing her student loans. Her granddaughter has since fallen behind on her private student loans, and both the grandmother and the granddaughter get many collection calls and letters indicating there's options available to you, give us a call, but when they try to call the servicer and take advantage of those supposed options, they're told you just have to become current. That's your only option. The grandmother that wrote our office has often received conflicting information from the loan servicer in writing and on the phone. She's been passed around to different representatives when she's trying to get answers, and has just really had a hard time getting a repayment plan in place for her granddaughter and for her. Sitting next to me is Mary Feider, and Mary and her mother, who's right here, her name is also Mary. We'll refer to them as Mrs. Feider and Mary just for simplicity. They took out student loans for Mary to attend school and had some surprises along the way with their student loans, and we'll have Mary talk a little bit about that situation.
Ms. Feider, welcome to the committee, and if you could state your name for the record, please.
Thank you. Mary Feider. I attended Globe University in 2007. I took one class while I was in high school, and while I was doing that, I furthered my education for an associate's degree in criminal justice. My mother and I went there to the financial aid place, and we sat down and we did some co-sign. My mom co-signed for me since I obviously couldn't. My bill was outrageous, and I was blessed that my mother came up with some money and paid for half of it, but I still do owe like $40,000. Basically, it increased so much that it's a distress on. I will never be able to pay my mom back the $30,000 that she put up.
And Mrs. Feider, do you have testimony you'd like to present?
Yes, my name is Mary Lou Feider, and according to my daughter, that is true. We were doing very well paying our loans off, until we both were laid off. First, she lost her job, and I says, it's going to be okay. I can help. And then 3 months later, I had lost my job. And thank God, we were blessed that I had the savings to pay the loan so it does not keep accumulating. And I did do a deferral, and I was my understanding was you do a deferral and then you don't need to pay the loan back until you get a job or financial have money. Well, that wasn't necessarily true. It went from a $17,000 loan to over a $36,000 loan, and it took all my savings and chances of me retiring. But thank God we were blessed, and she did have the money to go to school.
Thank you so much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Opening it up to the committee, any questions, comments from the committee members? Senator Nelson and Senator Pratt.
I couldn't tell when it talks about that, and again, this sounds like something's very much an issue that needs to be addressed. And does this legislation only pertain to, when you're talking about a private education loan, is that a private loan to any educational institution, or does this bill pertain only to non-public entities, or would these definitions and this language also pertain to our public institutions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson. The bill would apply to any private loans that are taken out by any students to cover the cost of post-secondary education expenses. Unfortunately, the Higher Education Act preempts us from regulating federal student loans. Students are certainly having issues with those as well, but we're trying to address as much of the problem as we can, which is students who take out loans to attend college through a private servicer or a private lender.
Thank you.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Ms. Popper. And I think you probably touched on my question. How did these disclosures compare with the disclosures that are required under the federal student loan program, and why wouldn't we have those sync up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Pratt. The Truth in Lending Act requires that covers private education loans and requires certain disclosures that are made to students before the loan is consummated, so prior to as they apply and as they're approved. What we've heard from students, however, as was the case for the FIDERS and another testifier who I think went to plug her meter. Students come out of school surprised by how the loans have added up. They fill out their information every term, and the money is dispersed to the school, but they really don't understand how those loans are adding up. This bill would require that disclosures be provided to students after the disbursement occurs every 3 months, so they can see how much they're taking out, how the interest is accruing. That's not an area that is currently regulated, and we are not preempted from filling in those gaps. TILA allows us to do that as far as disclosures, as long as they're not in conflict with that law.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So while this is talking about specifically private loans, when we're talking about the federal student loans, it's your understanding through Truth in Lending that we would have the same ongoing disclosures for federal student loans as we would for private student loans?
Mr. Chair and Senator Pratt, unfortunately, we can't regulate federal student loans. We're preempted from doing that. So these disclosures would only apply to private student loans.
I have a question, if I can, of the Ms. and Mrs. Fighter. Can I ask how you were directed to this loan? Is this something that the institution set up? And then secondly, could you share possibly what your interest rate was on the loan?
Yes, the institution suggested Sally Mae, and I'm not sure how much the interest rate was. Do you have an idea?
I'm not real sure. I don't know how much the interest rate is. It's been quite a while, but I know it was high.
All right, thank you. Senator Bonif, you had a comment?
Mr. Chair, I was just going to ask Ms. Pupor if she could give the committee a few examples of private so that the committee has in mind what we're talking about.
Yes, Ms. Pupor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Bonif. Two of the three largest private educational lenders are Sallie Mae and Discover Bank. Those are two that it would apply to. It also applied to institutional loan programs. Many schools offer private institutional loans to make up for the gap. They may not be able to qualify for private loan because they have bad credit or don't have a cosigner. It would also apply to loans through credit unions or other state chartered banks.
Thank you. Did you have any other testifiers, Senator Bonif?
Mr. Chair, no, not at this time. I know Senator Franson's got a bill, and then the banks would like to address both of them.
All right.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair and Senator Bonif. We have our testifier that came back from plugging her meter. Is she able to offer testimony?
Let's have the young lady testify. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Kate Schmitz, and Kate has both an associate's degree and a bachelor's degree. She has over $100,000 in student loans. She'd like to share a little bit about her experience with her loans.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, and again, if you could state your name for the record.
Kate Schmitz. I originally started attending the school in 2009. They did partially go over financial aid with me. Kind of went over real quickly what I'd be allowed for state and federal grants, and then what wouldn't be covered by them, I'd have to take out a loan, where they then forced me to apply for a private loan that they knew very well I'd get denied for. And once I did, they gave me what they call the last chance loan for EdUp at 18% interest rate, which I did receive. That's what I went with for the remaining time of my schooling. And then at the very end of my associate's degree, I asked them what I was looking at as far as the school bill goes. They told me I would receive a bill in the mail. That was it. I received a bill for $30,000. Had no idea. Plus the personal loan on top of that. So then I had no choice but to go back to school there because nobody would accept my credits. I then went back and reapplied for a loan again, and about 2 weeks or so before graduation, they told me I was looking at about $100,000 in school loans, with the payment ranging between $700 and $1,500 a month. So that's not including the personal loan that I did also have to take out. So I had no idea across the board what I was looking at financially.
Thank you for your testimony. Just a question again. Could you share with us again how you were directed to this particular loan at 18%?
I was told that I could apply for this loan. It was a loan that was a last chance loan for people that had bad credit or no cosigners, but I had to apply for another loan other than that first, knowing full well that I would get denied for this loan by myself.
And again, who directed you to that?
The financial aid counselor that I spoke with at the time.
At the institution in which you were attending?
Yes, at the institution.
Thank you. Senator Kent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Schmitz, what was your course of study?
I originally started in health and fitness for my associate's degree and then switched to cosmetology business. And my bachelor's was a bachelor's degree in criminal justice.
Thank you. Any other questions from the committee? All right. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Thank you.
With that, Senator Bonif, we will lay over Senate File 697 for consideration. And Senator Franson, Senate File 418.
Chair, members, good afternoon. I first of all would like to start by thanking my co-authors for Senate File 418, Senator Miller, Senator Bonoff, Senator Kent, and Senator Fischbach. Senate File 418 is a simple bill, I think much simpler than the ones we've heard before this afternoon. It requires private student loan lenders to make various disclosures before issuing a loan. This would apply to about 7% of the student loan market, as the majority of the market are federal lenders and therefore, as you've heard earlier, are exempt from state action and regulated by federal law. This bill is pretty straightforward. It aims to make lenders accountable to provide prospective students with information about the loan they are looking to take out. Student debt has become a significant problem, as we've heard, with the average student having about $30,000 in debt after completing college in Minnesota. This bill seeks to educate students about what a loan will cost them when they complete college and need to start paying it back. Briefly, the bill requires private student loan lenders to provide a written disclosure statement. The statement must contain, number one, a listing of the schedules a borrower may use to repay a student loan, including the estimated monthly payment based on the amount of the loan. Number two, an interest rate and whether it's fixed or variable. Number three, total amount of interest paid over the life of the loan for each repayment schedule. Number four, options for altering repayment scheduled if desired. And an example, lastly, number five, an example calculations of the repayment cost of the loan as a percentage of potential salaries that might be reasonably expected upon graduation. This bill, members, is needed for two reasons. One is transparency. The other is financial literacy. There is an inequality of information in this market. The private lender has the upper hand, and it's the party's mutual interest to get it right from the start. Not all, but generally speaking, we're dealing with a less savvy consumer who is entering into a binding contract that will affect them for the next few decades of their life, and we want to ensure that students understand what they will be obligated to repay. Students must have all the information necessary to make better decisions for their future. I think this bill highlights some of the concerns that we have heard from students that they're facing to earn an education in order to contribute to society. We should at the very least ensure they know what they are committing to and avoid any information blind spots. This bill empowers students to make better decisions, and this should not be a controversial proposition. I met with several private lenders who have expressed some concerns that similar requirements are already in place. However, my understanding is that these disclosure requirements happen at different points in the time in the relationship between the student and the lender, mainly in application, before consummation, and at signage. And therefore, it does not achieve the same level of transparency and clarity that this bill aims to achieve. I look forward to working with members of the committee, private lenders, and all stakeholders to address these concerns and to make sure that to make the intent of this bill feasible. And I am open for questions.
Any questions, members? Well, Senator Franz, and I think it's just because we had such a robust discussion, and you're right, your approach is just a much more simple approach to a similar issue. I'm trying to understand if in your bill, some of the issues that were raised in the other one, so for example, if a student had been going to school for a year and they hadn't yet finished, would they be getting up-to-date information about their loan? And it's,
Madam Chair, the bill is not explicit on that. My intent would be at the beginning of the relationship, and we can make that clear. However, the bill also requires a signature at one point, and I know that certain lenders will say that that's redundant, that there's already other aspects of their relationship with students that they would be a problem. So I'd be open to making it at that same time where you're already collecting the signature for the loan itself. So we might have to clarify that, and I'm open to suggestions from members and from stakeholders to make sure that it's very clear.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Senator Franzen?
Thank you.
Okay, very good. So now I know folks from the banking industry wanted to come forward. You're welcome to do that. Pass.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Tess Rice. I'm general counsel for the Minnesota Bankers Association. We'd like to thank Senator Bonhoff and Senator Franzen for meeting with us on their bills. We have some comments just about the private loan industry that we thought might be helpful, and then just a few comments about each of the bills.
the student loan industry is pretty big. It's $1.2-1.3 trillion, and so we're talking about, with private loans, 7 or 8% of that. So it's a much smaller group. These loans, these private student loans, are made by private lenders, and they're made differently than federal loans. These loans are underwritten to make sure that people can repay them. And so due to that, they have a much higher repayment rate. Their default rate is about 2.4% currently, which is very good. The federal loans are at about 14%, but there are estimates that when federal student loans all come in the repayment phase, their default rate can be as high as 40%. So underwriting these loans makes a big difference in, you know, figuring out if someone will actually be able to repay it. They are subject to the Truth in Lending Act, unlike federal loans. And the Truth in Lending Act is implemented under Regulation Z. And Regulation Z requires that a borrower self-certify or complete a form indicating that they understand the cost of attendance at their school. And that form also encourages them to use federal loans when possible. What happens, though, in the private student market is that almost every lender requires the school to also certify. So the school fills out a form and says, this is how much this is costing this student. And so that prevents any over-borrowing that might occur. So there are three model student loan disclosures that are used different times in the lending process. Now, they don't have to be used. The content all has to be given, but these are model forms. They are used almost exclusively, however, because they provide a safe harbor for lenders. So if they use these forms, they're deemed to be in compliance with Regulation Z. So their use is pretty much uniform in the private student loan sector.
Excuse me just for a moment, Ms. Mm-hmm. Rice. You said that these forms keep from over-borrowing, but yet we all know that if you have this default rate, there's over-borrowing because they borrowed more than they can possibly pay back. We just heard about a young woman who, you know, has $100,000 now in debt. So can you clarify what you mean when you say that they prevent over-borrowing when we have the kind of crisis that we're facing?
Madam Chair, what that means is the school has certified how much the program is costing. They have told the private lender, this is how much this student needs to borrow. So that doesn't mean that it isn't expensive. It doesn't mean that it's the right thing for that student, but it does mean that the school has said, this is how much it costs. So they can't be borrowing for other things beyond their tuition and costs.
Okay.
There are three forms that are given under Regulation Z, and the first one goes out. If a lender is trying to solicit students with an offer for a student loan, they will provide this information. They will also provide the same information when a person applies for a loan. And it gives them, it's a two-page disclosure, and it gives them what their interest rate could be. So it's a range from the smallest to the highest amount. It tells them that the rate's variable and what the ceiling rate will be, the highest amount that interest rate could go. It lists all the fees that could possibly be charged, and it gives examples of the loan cost. So it looks at, if you defer payments while you're in school, it shows you what your total amount's going to be at the end of that period. If you pay just interest during school, it'll show what your total amount will be at the end. And then if you make full payments while you're in school, it shows what that amount is. And then on the other side, it tells about all the federal loan alternatives that exist, the Perkins loans, Stafford loans, and gives what the interest rates are on those currently and says you may qualify for these. You need to talk to someone about that at your school. And then it says it again. So it's very clear that they should be looking to federal loans first. And then it says you have to self-certify. It makes clear that to go beyond the application stage, they have to certify what their needs are. And so that is the form at the beginning stage. Then when they apply and they're approved, there's a second form. And this will give them exactly what the interest rate will be, what their finance charges will be, any fees that go with this loan, and then an estimated repayment schedule and terms, again looking at if they made payments during school. And it looks at not only the interest rate they're starting with, but it looks at what your payments would be and your total costs if the interest rate got to that ceiling, that highest amount, so they know the very most it could be. Again, it gives the same federal loan information, encouraging them to find out about other options. And then once they sign the loan, they're given another very similar disclosure. And it contains almost all the same information, except that it also says you have a right to cancel this transaction. So you don't disperse money when you sign this loan. There's a right of rescission period for that student so they can cancel it. So they are given a lot of information about their loan, what their possible payments could be, then what they will be, and worst-case scenario, what they will be. So there's a significant federal framework in place, and this applies to all creditors. In one of the bills, Senator Franzen's bill, national banks are not included in the definition of the lender or the loan, so they are not. They would not have to follow those rules, but I did want to make clear that all state-chartered banks and credit unions also follow these federal rules, and they are examined at least every 18 months for their compliance with these rules by their bank examiners. So that's general background on the information that we're required to provide. Some general comments are that with Senate File 418, it provides one more disclosure. So I mentioned the three that we have. That disclosure would probably be along with the second disclosure. The requirements for delivery are different, and so, of course, any lender that would that makes loans nationwide, which most of those big student lenders are nationwide, they would have to create a new platform for Minnesota, so there would be an additional compliance burden there. The federal law does not require that you get a signed receipt from the borrower, but this bill would do that. The things that a couple points that where we're not duplicating the same information, most of it is the same information that they're already receiving. But one is that it requires example calculations of the repayment costs of the loan as a percentage of potential salaries that might be reasonably expected upon graduation. And that's information we don't think lenders are in a good position to know. I think, you know, a high school or college counselor would be more likely to have information about what their degree, what they could reasonably expect to make. We also worry that having it at the private loan stage probably isn't the right time. It should be earlier. These private loans are meant to fill in gaps, and they often occur later in the education when maybe their federal loan eligibility has run out. And another point is that these loans are generally, the average is about $10,000, and so they are smaller in size generally than the federal loans. And when you look at disclosing the payments, they're generally around $100. And so I think when you take that amount and you look at a salary that you might get, it probably won't look like very much. I mean, I don't think it will be a significant deterrent. We're also concerned that if we give information about what a potential salary will be, and we really don't know how we would ever know that, that might be misleading to a student, you know, because you might not get a job. So we don't want to be the ones telling them this is what you can expect to make. Regarding Senate File 697, again, I mentioned that national banks are exempt, which we really appreciate, but we would like to see the other entities that have to comply with this also exempted. We have general concerns about introducing a new regulatory scheme. We're told that no other state has anything like this. And this means that lending to Minnesota students requires more compliance, burden, and risk because there is a private right of action under this bill, which all translates into cost, meaning it's just going to be more expensive to lend to Minnesota students, and the qualifications will probably have to be higher as your risk increases in making that loan. When the federal rules came into effect in 2009, I think they were implemented in 2010, a lot of banks dropped out of the student loan market. The small banks dropped out because the compliance burden was too heavy to be able to make this business line even make sense. And so it had to go to a level where big banks at least could spread that cost out, that compliance cost out, and it could still make sense for them. But my concern is when you introduce a new scheme like this, we could lose more of those smaller lenders, the ones that are left, because this compliance burden is just too discouraging or too much where the risk isn't worth the return that they would get. There are some loss mitigation requirements in the bill, meaning you need to let a borrower know what their options are early in the process. And I don't know, that seems like that might be too soon when you're making the loan. We don't know what the loss mitigation options might be when they're done with school. Those things can change. Clearly, there could be contact information, but to have that information at that point might be misleading because things can change. And as far as I know, no lender has to offer loss mitigation. You know, if they don't think someone can pay the loan, but they also don't see any future in not charging it off, they're going to have to charge it off. The regulators don't let them hold these loans on the books indefinitely while they wait for someone to pay them back. And then there is a section on application of loan payments, how when a servicer receives loan payments, if the borrower hasn't specified which loan it should go to, and there's multiple loans that the servicer is servicing, I don't know if a servicer would have multiple loans, you know, from different borrowers, but there may be contractual obligations to pay a certain loan first. But this would require the highest interest rate be paid first and then the next highest interest rate be paid next. And so we're concerned about being able to do that with contractual requirements, and how do you choose one lender to pay over another if a borrower hasn't specified who it's supposed to go to. So those are just our general concerns with the bills. We really appreciate the opportunity to talk with Senator Bonoff and Senator Franzen about it.
Ms. Rice, when you said that you wished that the state banks and the credit unions, I believe, would also be exempted, so would that leave anyone in?
There are lenders that are not banks. I think Sallie Mae was mentioned.
Right.
I don't think they're a bank. I think there are other non-bank, like finance company type lenders. Now, they do have to follow these same rules. However, they are examined differently. They don't have the regulators coming in on a regular basis to make sure that they're following these rules. So it might be more driven by complaints. Maybe the Attorney General would go in, as we heard about today, and that kind of situation, rather than someone keeping a constant eye on what's going on.
Ms. Rice, we had, so we have four kids who've all finished college and had several of them in at one time, and so you put together a lot of different patchwork things to pay for school. And so for my daughter, we had four different loans, Parent Plus loans with Sallie Mae, and I was paying, you know, each month paying that Parent Plus loan, and I would add up all the loans because each year you had a different loan at a different rate, and came time we were doing something, and my credit was bad, and so I was like, what's going on here? And it turned out that I was noted as 6 months late for the student loan because they were taking my payment and applying it entirely to one of the loans, the principal, and then showing me as defaulting all those other loans. And so it took a lot of arguing, as you can imagine. They did correct my record, and then from then on, I only paid online because then I could show that I was doing each loan. Mm-hmm. But it took hours and hours and hours and hours of my time to clear that up. And so I think that one piece of the Attorney General's bill really resonated with mm-hmm. me, because I think there must be a problem with Sallie Mae in regard to that.
Madam Chair, yeah, I have heard that as well. Yeah, if you could craft the right language that would make sense. I mean, those were probably all Sallie Mae loans, and so
they
Sallie
were.
Mae was then...
Yes.
Yeah, I worry more about a multiple lender type situation.
Yeah, thank you. Senator Franzen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The only thing I wanted to make sure clarified for the record is I don't believe my bill exempts national banks. I believe it's the Attorney General's bill that does, and I think I heard otherwise. I just want to make sure that I heard correctly.
Madam Chair, Senator Friends, and that is my understanding. Yeah.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Rice, if I recall, it was the banking reform, the Dodd-Frank bill that changed student lending. Can you talk about the industry prior to Dodd-Frank and post-Dodd-Frank? Because I think some of the experience is coming prior to that law change. And I don't know if you can provide some flavor on how that industry has changed and what might be different from prior experience.
Ms. Rice.
Madam Chair, Senator Pratt. In 2010, when all the disclosures changed or were required
we had uniformity now. We had model forms that everyone could use. So on the positive side, I think it made things a lot clearer for borrowers, and it's possible that maybe some of our testifiers are dealing with situations before 2010. The negative aspect was what I mentioned before, was that when it got to be too much of a compliance burden, we lost a lot of lenders because they didn't have an additional compliance person that could handle that kind of thing. So it narrowed the market, I think, significantly. There were other reasons, too, some liquidity reasons, but, yeah, there was kind of two aspects to that.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anything else? Well, thank you, committee, for, I can see we lose people after the 3:30 time, but I appreciate the attention and the discussion, and we'll continue this in future sessions. So, yeah, all the bills are laid away. Okay, so with that, committee is adjourned.